Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD Ryzen Threadripper. We got a ship date and prices you'll love. Intel just launched a ton of Xeon processors, Mana prices, Akedio node, GPU toaster, quite a bit more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 423, recorded July 13th, 2017. Threadripper is coming, people.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/Twitch and get up to $150 off of a Ring security kit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, the most delightful bleeding-edge coverage of hardware mayhem available anywhere in this and any known or unknown universe. I feel so serious. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout, who is contemplating the joys of Xeon scalable processors and actual price and ship dates for the AMD Ryzen Threadripper. Sorry, I like saying Threadripper.
It's got a ring to it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It implies ass-kicking and name-taking. It's going to rip through those threads.
Yes. It's a very aggressive naming scheme.
Well, you know, this is a very aggressive move by... I mean, look, so AMD Ryzen Threadripper, 1950X, 1920X. You're talking about a 3.5 gigahertz, 12-core, the 1920X for $799, the 16-core, 3.4 gigahertz, 1950X costing $999, both turbo up to 4 gigahertz. You know, this is what I would affectionately call aggressive pricing.
It is,
at least
yeah.
Compared to the option, which would be an Intel processor.
Yep. So it's the first time that we've seen the model numbers. So 1950, 1920, it's the first time we've seen clock speeds. We know power draw now is 180 watts. And pricing is probably that most important data point. I kind of assumed this was going to happen, right? So Intel announced its Skylake X family of products first. Even before they launched the processors, they put out all the SKU listings and pricing. They left some of the clock speeds off, but we knew the 18-core part was going to be $1,999 and its 16-core part is going to be $1,699. And that gave AMD plenty of opportunity to, guesstimate the Intel performance and then measure their own, set clock speeds accordingly and set prices accordingly. So if you look at the $999 price point, which the 1950X, the brand new Threadripper 1950X will ship at, you're looking at 16 cores running at somewhere between 3.4 and 4.0, probably sustained. You're looking at 3.6 gigahertz or so on that clock speed. Just based on how Ryzen has done in the past. The $999 part from Intel is their 10-core part, the Core i9-7900X. So, for the same dollar amount, you're going from 10 cores to 16 cores. And then in terms of clock speeds, you're getting anywhere from, 100 megahertz slower on the base clock to 300 megahertz faster on the turbo clock for Intel parts. So this basically tells us, we don't have reviews live today. We only got one performance metric. It was all multi-threaded, but I assume single threaded performance will still show dominance to Intel, right? They have higher IPC and they're going to be able to get higher clock rates out of their part in single threaded and lightly threaded applications. But when you go into those multi-threaded things, multi-threaded tests, it's going to be a significant difference. If you look at that Cinebench score graph that I put in the story, that the two green bars are the numbers provided by AMD in today's information release. So we didn't run these numbers, just make sure we're clear about that. But the 7900X from Intel, the Core i9, is beat by 12% against AMD's 12-core part and by 39 to 40% by its 16 core parts. So these are not, you know, insignificant deltas of performance, especially if you look at the score of 3000 versus a score of 2100 are price competitive solutions. That puts Intel in a really tight spot.
Well, you know, as a consumer, it's a great spot to have Intel put in, right? You're looking at a 50% boost in performance, again, on massively threaded applications for the same price. That makes it a really easy decision. You know, you could also, you know, point out there are less expensive options, I think, for running the Threadripper than, say, X299 motherboards. Not to harp on the whole cost of running the top of the line Intel CPUs, which, you know,
no, it's super fair.
I think about the X99 launch. I look at the X299 launch. You know, and part of what's really frustrating about that is you know, don't get me wrong, I love a motherboard where somebody spent a lot of time looking at comic book drawings and figuring out weird things to put over the covers, you know, all of the various and sundry parts of the motherboard. And, you know, I do love having massive amounts of, you know, IO options and stuff. But there's moments when I'm looking at some of the motherboard options and I'm like, you know, I'd take a $150 motherboard that didn't have a whole bunch of this stuff on there that nobody actually needs if they're primarily, you know, doing work tasks or productivity based tasks on this. The cost in those motherboards were brutal, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't upgrade to an X99 based system last year. So it's like, no, I'm not going to take a marginal, you know, a moderate increase in performance and spend, you know, $1,000 on a processor and $350 on a motherboard, you know, and then you're looking at this and it's like $1,000 processor, you know, giving you 50% more work than the competitive $1,000 processor. And then you've got a whole array of motherboard options, which makes me kind of happy, or at least makes the cheap, stingy part of me incredibly happy.
We don't yet know the cost of the platform for Threadripper yet. I mean, the processor is going to be a better value for AMD. I actually kind of think that the motherboard prices will be equivalent, just guessing. Okay. But if you look at actual build cost, you know, you still have this enormous socket, bigger than the one for LGA 2066 for Skylake X. You know, there's tons of PCIe lanes on this processor, 64 lanes of PCIe. So there's...
Which is awesome.
You would think these motherboard guys are going to find ways to fill that capacity with accessories and add-ons and features and capability. I'm thinking like $250 for a motherboard for Threadripper is going to be probably right. I put in some questions to some of the motherboard guys to see kind of what they might say about it. It's also good if you look at the next table down, actually, that shows all of the Ryzen lineup as it stands today, leaving out the Ryzen 3s that were announced as well. It's important also note, this is technically called the Ryzen Threadripper 1950X and Ryzen Threadripper 1920X, as if we needed another couple of syllables to go with it. But so we start at 16 and then 12 and then 8, 6, 4, and the Ryzen 3 parts are 4 core, 4 thread. It's interesting because we were having discussions here today about, you know, there's a pretty good gap between the 1920X and the 1800X in terms of price, you know, $799 to $499. Interesting that AMD chose to not, at least yet, announce or release or talk about a part that can fit between that, you know, maybe a 10-core processor. I don't know if that is a limitation of, you know, how much production they can get in, or if there were, you know... It was hard to find a part that could be priced between there that showed enough of a difference from either of the abutting processors to warrant the extra part. But interesting, it looks like there is some wiggle room there between the 1920X and the 1800X to maybe squeeze in another part if they wanted to. I mean, you know, kind of go after you know, a 10-core part at $599 or $699, how much better or worse performance would it be compared to the 8-core Skylake X that Intel did aggressively price at $599, which actually might explain why they didn't do it, because they would have to price it accordingly, maybe too close to the 1800X because of what Intel did, was able to do or did do, I guess. And speaking of Intel, it does, you know, their 16 core part is going to be $700 more expensive than the AMD 16 core part, which is,
that's a lot of money.
That's significant. That is a high amount of variance there. And, you know, it'll be better. It'll be a faster part. Like it will, like the clock speeds will probably be higher and the IPC will probably be higher or will definitely be higher. So we assume it will be more expensive, but how much more for $700 is definitely worth, you know, keeping in mind. For me, if you are a, you know, prosumer type person, which I kind of don't like that term, but if you're like a heavy, heavy multitasker, you do video editing on the side, mm-hmm. or photo editing, or you do production, and but you're not, you don't work at a studio that's spending $8,000 on your workstation for you. Threadripper looks like a kick-ass part for that, right? Like this is your, it's not a budget, but your budget flagship part, right? This is what Extreme Editions at $999 kind of used to be, but they didn't have any competition. They were just competing against themselves. Intel was just always going against their own products. So Intel did adjust pricing, but they didn't adjust it a whole bunch. So that left some room for AMD to make this part. And hopefully this allows them to be, make a little bit of margin on these parts for this audience that really needs it, and continue to use that money to develop and improve on Zen 2, Zen 3, and everything down the line.
And while we're talking about hardware bargains, right, we've all been excited about VR. We've all been a little traumatized by the price of VR, not so much on the cell phone side of things, but certainly on the desktop side of things. And it looks like 2018 is going to be the year that Facebook tries to really popularize the Oculus Rift. Quote, a device that will sell for as little as $200 and need not be tethered to a PC or phone, according to people familiar with its development. And what we're talking about is a new VR rig that does not require a cell phone and apparently will not require being tethered to a PC. That is a big deal. I don't know how else to say that. This is going to be presumably a huge, performance improvement over the existing cell phone-based stuff. When you're taking a look at the everything from the Samsung Cardboard, the Google Cardboard, the Samsung headsets, the Gear VR, it also puts the price drop for the Oculus Plus Touch, which came out a few days ago for $399, which on one hand is a fantastic deal, because this would have been a heck of a lot less expensive a few weeks ago. I had a friend of mine talk me off the ledge for this. He's like, wait for the HTC Vive, understand that there's going to be an announcement from Oculus that's going to have new hardware. Because his frustration is that he has to constantly recalibrate his Oculus Rift rig. So he was telling me to hold out a little longer for the HTC Vive or to see what comes next. So if you're thinking about buying an Oculus Rift, well, now you know why they're so cheap. especially given that they're bundling the touch controllers with them now, it's because they got something brand new and half the cost of the reduced price of the Rift plus the touch controllers coming out.
I think so. What's interesting is the story that Bloomberg is talking about for the wireless Oculus VR headset is that's going to be one that is essentially, it's based on a Snapdragon processor. It's going to be an all-in-one unit, right, based on a high-end mobile processor, but still a mobile processor. So the types of experiences you get with the thing that, Bloomberg is reporting on, that will absolutely exist, and Qualcomm's been building these development kits for a while, right, is still going to be very different than the kind of VR you get out of your PC through your Rift or through your Vive, just in terms of the types of games they run and the controller capabilities and the general experience you can have with it. So I wouldn't consider what they're doing a replacement for the PC VR, more of a replacement for the idea of something like Gear VR, right? Where, right, and I was probably one of these people that thought the idea of having this thing that you plug your phone into every once in a while when you want to do VR was really cool. But as it turned out, I don't really want to kill my phone battery throughout the day, right? And you're basically, you have to sacrifice one for the other, or you're doing this at home anyway, and you're ready to charge or something like that. But the idea of a self-contained one is just kind of like you just throw it on and you go. You don't care about what phone you have, if the new phone you bought is compatible with the old version, and you know, all the sensors are kind of integrated into it, so you can actually have better sensors on this unit, mm-hmm. better camera, more appropriate cameras, I guess I would say, than something like the Gear VR, because it's not just using the phone device. That's really where I think the advantage of the whatever the $200 headset, which I've known about these kind of standalone Snapdragon based headsets for a while. $200 is super aggressive if that's actually a target, because you know, I was thinking more in line with like $600 to $800, you know, $500 to $600 maybe, in line with the price of a high-end smartphone, because you're essentially duplicating right. the componentry of a high-end smartphone, but actually adding a little bit to it to get slightly better VR integration. But maybe you save on BOM cost by not having GPS or something to that degree. I don't really know, but $200 seems it's super, super aggressive.
And I think that's partially, you know, to maybe temper my enthusiasm about what's coming on the PC side of things. You know, when you talk about Facebook having relatively bottomless pockets, you know, aggressively, you know, debuting a $200 price point, selling what I assume is at a loss or close to a loss, you know, technically for, you know, a temporary period, it's not a permanent reduction in price. They say the Oculus mm-hmm. Plus Touch bundle, you know, maybe what they're trying to do right now is just beat the hell out of HTC, and the Vive, and just try to narrow the market as much as possible, or place themselves at the center of the market to be able to call the shots. And yeah, you're absolutely right. A mobile processor is not going to deliver the same visual experience as a PC powered headset. But you know, I like the idea of having something at that price range, you know, hammering down on the price range of the headsets. Mm-hmm. You know, and I may also underestimate the cost of production and the parts cost on the headsets. And perhaps should, you know, temper my enthusiasm for a price drop on that one. But again, you know, Ryan's looking for the 5 cent a gigabyte SSD prices, so I'm going to be looking for the significant reduction in VR. probably not so inexpensive in any sense of the word, in terms of initial investment, at least. The Xeon Scalable processor launch, new architecture, new platform for data centers. And, you know, expensive parts aren't expensive if they allow you to do a lot more work or significantly reduce your electrical bills or your cooling bills at a data center. This is a crazy launch. I was reading your article on this. 50 processors, 7 chipsets, falling under the Xeon Scalable product brand from, you know, data centers mm-hmm. and enterprise customers in a wide range of markets and segments. This is nuts.
yeah. So if you look at like what AMD did with Epic, their launch a few weeks ago, it was very specific and targeted towards like 1 socket, 2 socket systems. Here's a half dozen workloads that we know our processor will do very well in. Xeon is like 99.5% of the data center market. So they basically, when they do a release, it has to cover everything from, you know, 2 socket, right. 4 socket, 8 socket, you know, all the way from 8 cores to 28 cores. Like they're doing a very wide range. But yeah, launching 58 different SKUs makes writing a story about it very convoluted, just trying to figure out like even what you want to focus on and what you want to talk about. You know, they're changing their branding to be like platinum, gold, silver, bronze to try to create some...
Well, and there's multiple some layers of like gold.
Things. Yeah, right? That's like even worse because there's gold 6100 and gold
series.
Yeah,
5100.
It's there's just tons of options as you look through it, right? Like the platinum has up to 1.5 terabytes of memory if you get an M SKU, mm-hmm. but if you don't have an M SKU, it's 768. gigabytes of memory, which is, you know, still substantial. As you go from gold to 6100X to gold 5100X, you lose one of the FMA processors, one of the FMA units per core. So like your AVX 512, your you know, extensions in that regard are halved in speed. There's they all have six channels of memory. So there's that. There's six channels of DDR4 memory. So it's kind of the first release of that. The Skellig X only integrated four channels of memory. But if you look at the diagrams of specs and you go to the second page and you look at the table that I put together with pricing, it's super complex. The essential takeaway from this is you're looking at the Skylake X, the Skylake upgrade to Xeon server class processors. We were on Broadwell previously. Now we're on Skylake, just like Skylake X for the HEDT. This is Skylake SP for servers. And yeah, there's a lot. And they start, like, they can go as high as $13,000 and as low as a few hundred, I think, actually, they get down to. Yeah, what's that, 417 or something like that? So it's not quite at the bottom, but it's in there.
When you're looking at the bronze parts, you're talking about 8 cores max, 2 sockets max, no turbo boost. A relatively tame processor when you're talking about the stuff up at the platinum level, which is, 28 core, 8 socket, 3 UPI links, 6 channel DDR4, right, 2666, up to 1.5 terabytes of memory. I mean, they're serving a just a staggering array of potential needs.
And, it's similar to what we were talking about, Skylake X versus Threadripper, the Epic versus Xeon Scalable is an interesting debate. Even though the Epic product family does not cover nearly the scope that Xeon does, in the areas that it does cover, the Xeon parts are priced higher. Now, this is a very different market because when you have 99.5% market share and you have the software ecosystem and the customer base and the support system set up, enterprise customers are less likely than a consumer to just suddenly swap platforms, right? If Xeon has been working for them and they know this in and out, the likelihood of them suddenly just going, let's just try AMD for our mission critical applications is smaller. So AMD is going to have to do a lot more work to get those people interested and excited and buying into it, especially if, we were lamenting about the fact that there's a $13,000 processor in this stack, 28 cores, 56 threads, the one with the max memory capacity of 1.5 terabytes. But here's the thing, and it's up to support for up to eight sockets of processors. If you're building a system, if you are a system designer and you're worried about, can I get one more than a terabyte of memory in here and can I get eight sockets? The chances are that $13,000 per processor is not really the most expensive part of your build. Right? Getting 1.5 terabytes of memory per socket is probably going to be more expensive or close than the processor itself. And if you're doing this, chances are you're attaching a processor like this or a system like this to 75 NVMe drives running database applications, right? And that's going to significantly outweigh the cost of your processor. So even though these are very expensive and way outside the realm of where, consumers are used to seeing parts, it's not out of the out of place in that particular market. Lower would be better and that's kind of what AMD is going for. But at the end of the day, if you're building a $600,000 server infrastructure, having a $13,000 versus an $8,000 processor is not that big of a change for you.
Which brings us, back to the idea that nobody ever got fired for buying an Intel server, may not be true, but nobody ever got fired for buying IBM, right? That was the old line.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see how how well that segment does for AMD and who ends up buying it. Because if you're building $600,000 server clusters, you're also generally serving, incredibly important, customer groups that you cannot possibly afford to tick off. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. We're brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Ring's mission to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over 1 million people use the amazing Ring Video Doorbell to help protect their homes, including, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. That's why they're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's video doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. With HD video and two-way audio, it lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. See and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. And with Ring's floodlight cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Doesn't matter if you're home or traveling, the Ring floodlight cam lets you keep an eye on your home. It offers the ultimate in home security with high visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands and named the Wall Street Journal's best of CES 2017. And if you really want to step it up, monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit. All kits include a Ring Video doorbell and your choice of either one, two, or three floodlight cams. Connect your Ring Video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. With Ring, you're always home. Save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/twitch. That's ring.com/TWICH. And we want to thank Ring for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting, man. You got to test that. We were talking about this on Twitter, and I didn't realize you'd got one in for testing. Ken went nuts on the Ikidio node, which sounds like an obscure anime that came after Aeon Flux, but is actually Monoprice's Thunderbolt toaster, which sells for $300. You know, it's a box with a Thunderbolt controller and a 400-watt SFX power supply inside. And, you know, way more space than you would think is necessary for a GPU. But, you know, there are worse things than having plenty of space to work with. Ken ran this with a ThinkPad X1, installed the NVIDIA drivers for the GTX 1080 Ti, and I quote, "Everything seemed to work, including using the 1080 Ti with the integrated notebook display and no external monitor." How'd the performance testing look?
So the interesting thing that we found was that there was noticeably more variance in frame times and more stutter and kind of animation concerns when using the Thunderbolt dock as opposed to having it internally. And we did this testing. So we first hooked it up to a laptop and just kind of thought, oh, it's all going to work. And we were playing some games at 1080p with the GTX 1080 Ti and saw a fairly heavy amount of stutter in the games. So what we did is kind of like a case study, if you will, was we hooked the external Thunderbolt 3 dock up to a desktop PC and with the 1080 Ti in it, basically taking away CPU bottleneck, taking away more of the platform bottlenecks that may exist. So we then compared having a 1080 Ti internally in the system versus having a 1080 Ti hooked up to the desktop system through the Thunderbolt dock. Now, you would never actually do this in real world. That kind of defeats the whole purpose. But for us, it allowed us to get like, here's the best case scenario for this Thunderbolt dock versus, you know, an internal GPU in a system. And as it turns out, like, you know, the frame rates were lower, which we expected, but there was significantly more frame rate or frame time variance, which would cause things like stutter. And so now, you know, knowing now that inherently with the current driver stack and software implementation that you're going to lose some performance, which we did kind of expect, you know, in Hitman, we went from 150 to 110 frames per second at 1080p. But if you look at that graph, there's a lot more variance in the black line than in the orange line, which represents the black line is connected through the Thunderbolt dock. If you go down to, you know, that's kind of the case through all these different games, more or less. If you go to the second set of results where you see Hitman again, you're going to see the Thunderbolt 3 dock hooked up to a Lenovo ThinkPad notebook. It's a modern, thin and light, you know, 2-core, 4-thread Kaby Lake processor. This is kind of the target market, I feel, for these Thunderbolt docks, right? You have a thin and light notebook. Sure. It has no discrete graphics, and you want to hook it up to discrete graphics, right? So, and in this one, you see now the average frame rate goes from 110 to 60, so a significant drop in average frame rate. If you go down to the next graph, you'll see that the orange line represents the ThinkPad with a 1080 Ti on it, and there's a huge amount of even more variance than existed on the desktop system with a 1080 Ti. It's still playable. It's just suboptimal to do this. And usually anything over, you know, 95th percentile, anything over 4 milliseconds or so we kind of consider to be detrimental to the gaming experience itself. But this happened in Hitman. This happened in Witcher 3. In Dirt Rally, it even happened to a much less degree. So like the variance was fine, but it was still much worse than it was connected to the desktop. So there's still something up with the external graphics as a whole, right? And we're trying to get some more units in to do more testing. The question came up in our podcast last night. Well, is this just something inherent to this particular dock? Because it's the first one we've tested with our frame rating capture system. And the answer is maybe, but probably not.
I'm looking at these numbers there's absolutely a possibility that it could be the toaster in question, but this just smells like it's an issue with Thunderbolt implementation or the Thunderbolt drivers, or just the additional overhead that Thunderbolt's adding into this. I mean, I have a funny feeling this is something that will be resolved by Intel with a driver update somewhere.
It kind of feels like that. There's also, the frame variance got worse when we went from our 8-core desktop system to our 2-core laptop, indicating that maybe there's a CPU overhead issue at work, right? So it may never go away completely for those dual core hyper-threaded parts, because in general, high performance gaming running on dual core machines is just not ideal anymore. We'll see more quad core machines coming out in the near term, by the end of this year probably, and that may help address some of it too. If you look at the inside of this box, the Akitio node, like it's literally a PCB with a controller to connect to Thunderbolt and then a power supply. And that's basically it. There's not much for it to screw up. Not that it's not possible, mm-hmm. but there's just not much for it to do to screw up. Now, to verify that, Gigabyte is releasing a external dock with an integrated GTX 1070. I think tomorrow or today as we record this, whatever it happens to be. So I'm trying to hit them up and try to say, hey, send us one of these. We want to go through all the testing on it as well. You look at Alienware sells one, Razer sells one, and I've just never had hands-on experience with them, and I don't know if there's a reason for that now, as opposed to if you just run average frame rate benchmarks and you get a score of some kind that it seems fine. So, we'll be doing some more inquiries and figuring out what's going on. I guess we'll just guess and figure it out from there.
You sound a little less than hopeful on this one.
Yeah.
You sound a little less than hopeful on this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe a lot less than hopeful on this one. I got to see this in a NDA preview several weeks ago, but it was one of the things that really stuck out for me. New coming from Dell this year, the Latitude 12-inch 7285, which is a 2-in-1 business laptop with wireless charging. And it requires a kind of a big mouse paddy kind of base to do the wireless charging, but it's $750. It has a fantastic feel on the keyboard, like a typical Dell keyboard experience. It's excellent. But it's like a 12-inch, 2-in-1. I guess I want to say it was, first announced way, way, way back in CES. But this is, detachable keyboard, incredibly sturdy build. I mean, it's a Latitude, right? It's their commercial line. It's their enterprise line. The wireless charging keyboard, wireless charging mat is $549, and the actual Latitude itself is $1,200. So it's a that's with a Core i5 7y54, 128 gigabyte SSD and 8 gigs of memory. So a reasonable price for that. But again, this is priced mm-hmm. for enterprise consumption, not for consumer consumption. But it is an interesting idea that they are bringing the wireless charging laptop to the world. Or at least to large corporations. So I'm kind of excited about that one. And the build quality on it is absolutely fantastic.
I'd like to see more of this, after the announcement of the Logitech wireless charging mouse that, mm-hmm. Charges while you use it. This is to me like the future of stuff. It's not perfect yet, but more of this in the market will definitely, I think, bring people to the idea and thus employ more companies to develop these products and implement them.
In case you're looking for 10 gigabit Ethernet in the home, Asus is gunning for you. The XGC100C NIC, Ken titled this 10 gigabit Ethernet for the masses. You know, this is something people have wanted, I guess, if you're doing massive file transfers or want to see just exactly how fast you can back your PC up. You know, you're usually looking at spending hundreds of dollars on a 10 gigabyte board. And this one's running in a Quantia AQC108 controller, and we're looking at an MSRP of $100. That is cheap.
It's cheap, and you know, some people pointed out that you can buy like used Intel gigabit NICs or 10 gigabit NICs on eBay for less than this, which is true. One of the advantages to this controller, which is being used not just by Asus but by some others as well, is that it actually falls back to 5 gigabits and 2.5 gigabits before going back to 1 gigabit. So, you know, the move to 10 gigabit Ethernet is one of those things that I, you know, just from a work and production standpoint, wished had been occurring quicker, you know, lower costs more quickly. Right. You know, being able to get over a gigabyte per second of throughput on your network controller is a substantial upgrade over 100 megabytes, right? So,
right.
You know, there are some people that are confused about, well, my internet connection is, you know, 300 megabits. Why do I care about any of this? And that's looking at it the wrong way. This is PC to PC connections. This is if you back up your PC, if you do video production work, you know, Alan brought up the idea that you don't, you have the ability now to like scrub through 4K content over a network that you wouldn't have had otherwise, right? So maybe you can readjust how your resources in your office and in your home business or whatever actually work. These are using, you know, low cost cards. These are low cost cards, you know, $100. I think they're selling for like 110 or 115 on Amazon right now. We just bought these two, connect them to two PCs and got 9.46 gigabits per second of throughput, right? So like pretty close to what the rated capabilities actually are. We had Creator's Edition, which just had the driver. It just grabbed the driver automatically. Either it was already in the system or Windows Update grabbed it. So like setup and installation was super easy. We just used standard Cat5e cable for our run, and it was maybe like a 30, 40-foot cable that we were using. Switches are still kind of the expensive part here. You're currently looking at $80 to $100 per port on a switch as well. So if you get like an 8-port gigabit switch, you're probably looking at $600 to $700, which is really, really pricey, and that's, you know, that's where I think a lot of people will start to balk at that type of stuff. But if you have, you know, a NAS and a PC, like two PCs that just need to communicate with this, you can have their normal gigabit connections to your network, and you can have these two 10 gigabit NICs in there for $100 each and have them communicate at that much higher speed. You know, the number of use cases for that is lower, but if you know about 10 gigabit Ethernet and you think it's interesting, chances are you have a use case which would validate the cost of something like this, right? So like for us in this kind of environment where we're moving large files around pretty often, it makes sense for us to buy 6 or 8 of these, put them in all the machines, you know, cough up the money for a switch, and then have that as its, you know, root network for those groups of machines. I'm just, you know, we've seen motherboards start to have these on them now, and now we've got these add-in cards, PCIe by 4. And I think the fallback to 5 gig and 2.5 gig is actually going to be pretty important too, because you're going to see routers and switches with 2.5 and 5 gigabit ports on them very soon that will be much less expensive than 10 gigabit. So, you know, you may be buying a router in December or just after CES next year that has, you know, two 2.5 gigabit ports and then 6 1 gigabit ports, and you connect the PCs to the right ones, and then it's handling all the traffic internally the right way. You look at, you know, I think Comcast is the company that offers, they have a 2 gigabit internet service capability. You know, there's a use case for that as well. So it's to me, I'm pretty excited about this because we've had specific bottlenecks in our workflow where,
yeah,
you know, we would want to transfer a file, like, but we have this 26 gig uncompressed video file. How do we get it to the server? Well, does it make more? It was actually faster to transcode it on the local machine and then copy it over, as opposed to just copying it over and having a machine that is non-mission critical, that's not doing active work, do the transcoding at a convenient time, right? So to me, this kind of immediately solves that particular problem as well. Do you have any in your business and or work, or home, I guess, do you have any, would 10 gigabit benefit you in any substantial way, do you think?
You know, if I connect all four Ethernet ports of my NAS to a gigabit switch that is connected to a 10 gigabit switch and use that to connect to my desktop PC, then yes, I could back stuff up faster. And in the office, because we're moving video files around, then it certainly makes it compelling. We're not pushing quite as much video as you are. I mean, we're doing like 300 gigabytes a week. And I think you guys are probably doing that every couple of hours when you're doing some of the high-end testing. But, you know, I can see a demand for it. I can more see it, the demand for it that's coming up in, larger offices, enterprises, and video production shops. But me personally, I got a couple of the early cards to play around with. And they're neat, but not having a switch makes them really, really hard to operate. So, that's the big one, is getting the switch prices. Now, I mean, you can pick one up. There's some as low as like $75 a port, but you're still talking about dropping $600 for an 8 gigabyte switch, which is a pretty significant investment that, again, I don't particularly need in my house, but I can see in another year or two, especially if I start moving to 4K video production, that's going to be a very, very attractive option. A couple last thoughts before we go. Virtu, originally started by Nokia, is the luxury cell phone lineup. It's out of business. Closing their UK manufacturing operations, cutting 200 jobs. So if you've been thinking about buying a $10,000 smartphone, you'll be looking on eBay or whatever hipster, rich international jet setting eBay equivalent there might be out there. It was crazy realizing this goes back all the way to 1998 for the original launch. But there are a couple $100 million in debt right now. So apparently there weren't that many people looking for the super expensive gold plated cell phone markets. And the other thing is I thought this was interesting, right? We've got, Amazon's doing things like making their Fire TVs controllable by an Amazon Echo. Google Home's rapidly trying to catch up to the Amazon the Alexa experience by adding in things like, oh, you can finally upload music to be able to play through Google Home. In the meanwhile, there's been extensive, not particularly useful, but certainly extensive displays inside of Best Buy and other consumer electronics stores, and now Apple has unveiled a smart home experience in 46 of its retail stores worldwide. 28 in the United States, another 15 scattered around the world. It's, I think they're trying to figure out how to make HomeKit make sense to Apple users. Not that there's any intellectual challenges in the Apple community, but just I think they've done a terrible job of explaining what HomeKit is. And also because I think it's just at this point desperately trailing behind not just Amazon's Echo, but Google Home, especially when you start realizing the staggering number of dots that Amazon shipped in Prime Day this week. It's interesting, right? In case this is the first time you've ever heard of Home, it's Apple's Home app. It's going to control all the HomeKit-enabled, Internet of Stuff devices in your home from a single app. Mm-hmm. You can group together devices, to create scenes. That means, you can have one command and, either talk to Siri to have it do that or, tap on the phone. I think it's just going to make HomeKit understandable and then hopefully allow them to build the homes, you know, the HomeKit construction. I don't know. We also, in case you forgot, also have the impending launch of the HomePod, which was announced at WWDC, yep. Which is, of course, Apple's Echo competitor, which is really more of a Sonos competitor that happens to contain Siri pretending to be Echo. But we're going to have to wait to see what that looks like when it launches. But it seems like Apple's finally ramping up in an attempt to catch up with Google and who is still attempting to catch up with Amazon in the voice-based home management universe. So we shall see, ladies and gentlemen. We shall see.
I do have tomorrow sometime I will be getting in the water-cooled variant of the Vega Frontier Edition that I paid $1,500 of my own American currency for some reason. We'll figure out, I guess. There's a small chance that we reproduce the idea of doing a live stream for that tomorrow. It all depends on when it actually shows up in the office. It's a small chance, and I don't expect there to be a huge change in performance either, which is what made 2 weeks ago's exhibition in live streaming graphics card performance benchmarking so interesting. But we will definitely be taking a look at that in the near term. I'm trying to see if there's anything else that popped up in my news feed that we didn't really cover here. Yeah, I don't really know. We're going to do some more. I have hit up Intel directly for some answers to the whole X299 VRM overheating and power consumption issue on Skylake X, to which they don't have a good answer for me yet, which is somewhat disappointing considering this product launch is several weeks old now. So maybe by this time next week, we will have either one of two things, our own kind of testing to validate the problems and talk about it, or two, an actual answer from Intel on why things are acting the way they are, despite all of their claims building up to this release being that it was not the case. So as far as I'm told, engineers are hard at work, but I, you know, need to see those results first.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Robert and I had some fun at AVXL this week. We went down to NanoSys to talk to them about quantum dot technology, where it is, how it works, and what the future of it looks like. That one's up at AVXL.com. And we got a little bit nuts on Tech Thing this week, talking about how to figure out. We had a viewer that was looking at incredibly poor performance on their VPN. So we talk about tools you use to figure out where your internet connection to a particular server, for example, is being slowed down. You know, talking about ping, trace routes, and MTR. So it's fun stuff. We nerd out a little bit, and this is definitely a show where we nerd it out a lot. So techthing.com is a place for that. PCPer.com is Mr. Shrout's regular website. And I want to thank you all for joining us on This Week in Computer Hardware. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.